I just hope it's not too little too late. I mean, it has been a long, long time in coming.
Congress passes the bill transferring 70,000 acres of the Tongass to Sea Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 10 years after the Selandang IU grounding, how likely is an Aleutian shipping disaster?
And if you throw in near misses, you can easily call one a year, just right here in our local waters. It's not as out of the box as we might like to think it is.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
It's been a big week for Alaska in Congress. Lawmakers removed the Alaska exemption in the Violence Against Women Act, a significant gain for advocates of tribal authority. The Senate is still considering a $1.1 trillion bill to fund the government through next fall. Among its Alaska items are $50 million for the missile defense system housed at Fort Greely and $3 million for the Kodiak spaceport. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's pleased the bill properly reimburses tribal health care providers for contract support costs. It also has $10 million for sanitation in rural Alaska and another $10 million for the Denali Commission. It does not buy any new icebreakers, but it has $25 million for sonar mapping of the U.S. coastline with emphasis on the Bering Straits and the Arctic. The bill, though, zeroes out the Secure Rural Schools program. It paid $12 million last year to Alaska school districts, primarily in Southeast. The Senate has to pass the bill in the coming days to avoid a government shutdown. It has until Wednesday night. A bill transferring 70,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest to Sea Alaska passed Congress. The measure is attached to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is on its way to the president's desk after a Senate vote today. The legislation completes the Southeast Regional Native Corporation's land selections promised by the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Sea Alaska could have chosen other lands earlier, but this bill gives it access to more valuable timber stands, economic development locations, and heritage sites. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who authored the measure, says it will help more than Sea Alaska.
You also have the aspect of the economic benefit that is conveyed when these lands that were in federal hands are now transferred for an opportunity for increased recreational tourism, and also for economic interests such as timber harvest.
Critics have called the bill a giveaway that will damage fish and wildlife habitat. It's been strongly opposed by environmentalists, sportsmen's groups, and communities near potential logging sites. The corporation has come close to shutting down its timber division in recent years as it's run through forests on earlier land selections. Murkowski says she hopes the bill will help turn around the industry.
I just hope it's not too little too late. I mean, it has been a long, long time in coming. And if you haven't had an opportunity to visit with anyone in the timber industry in Southeast lately, it's pretty skimpy down there.
Representative Don Young sponsored the bill's original version. Senator Mark Begich co-sponsored Murkowski's legislation. 19 AmeriCorps volunteers throughout the state were told this week their positions, including stipends and benefits, could end on Monday. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
As a second-year AmeriCorps member, Maya Wolf volunteers at Discovery Southeast, a nature education nonprofit. She got the news from Saga the same way fellow AmeriCorps volunteers in Juneau, Anchorage, Homer, Seward, and Cordova did. In a teleconference Tuesday, the volunteers thought they had secure positions through July. Wolf says they're frustrated.
It's financially difficult for a lot of people. We're coming out of college. We don't have a lot of savings. And so not having something lined up and having so little time to look for a new position is difficult.
Saga has been bringing AmeriCorps volunteers to Alaska for 20 years to work on service projects on public lands and volunteer with schools and nonprofits. Discovery Southeast Executive Director Sean Isley says the organization plans to support Wolf for the full length of her contract, regardless of what happens to the AmeriCorps program. AWARE hopes to do the same for its AmeriCorps volunteer. Sarah Lynn Tabachnik is the executive director of Juno's Domestic Abuse and Sexual Assault Prevention Nonprofit. She says the AmeriCorps volunteer at AWARE serves as a children's advocate and fills a real need.
She works with kids who are living in shelter, acclimates them to shelter, spends time with them, safety plans with them, facilitates groups for them, helps them feel like the unique people that they are.
Tabachnik says if SAGA's AmeriCorps program doesn't get picked up by another organization, AWARE will try to raise funds to keep its volunteer on as long as possible. Faith Lee is a coordinator of SICA AmeriCorps, the program that might take on SAGA's volunteers. If it's financially viable, Lee says SICA AmeriCorps could ensure SAGA members had support to complete their terms.
We would take on all of the reporting, filing, payroll, health insurance.
The SICA School District runs the community's AmeriCorps program. Lee says the administration is figuring out what the budget implication of doubling the number of AmeriCorps members will be to the district. SAGA receives $250,000 in federal funds, as well as community contributions, to run its 11-month AmeriCorps program. Lee hopes SICA AmeriCorps can help out.
I felt really bad that 19 young adults were maybe not going to have an advocate, and that's something that I really take to heart because I want them to have a great experience. I want them to leave a footprint and make an impact and feel good about their service and hopefully continue to volunteer for the rest of their lives.
Lee says SICA's six-year-old AmeriCorps program and SAGA's have had a great relationship in the past.
They actually mentored us and shared everything when we first took on AmeriCorps. Without them, we'd have really struggled. SAGA has contributed to our state for many years. If I can help in any way, I am more than happy to put that extra time in.
SAGA board member George McGuan says faced with a $350,000 debt and no way of repaying it, the board is seeking legal counsel to figure out what to do next. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
SITCA AmeriCorps decided this afternoon to take over SAGA's AmeriCorps program, allowing the 19 volunteers to finish their contracts through July. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a shop owner in Juneau who sells used books and rare maps.
When you drop by your shop, if there's somebody else there, in no time at all, you're all involved in the conversation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1st, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents has approved a policy banning smoking and other tobacco use on its campuses statewide. The language passed by regents during a meeting in Anchorage yesterday says the university is committed to providing a safe and healthy environment for its students, employees, and visitors by prohibiting tobacco use and smoking, including the use of electronic cigarettes and similar products within its campuses and facilities. No funding is attached to the policy, which will be up to campus communities to implement. Tobacco use will be allowed inside private vehicles. The ban takes effect December 1st of 2015. Jay Butler is returning to his job as the state's top doctor. Butler will be both the state's chief medical officer and director of the Division of Health. John Sherwood will be deputy commissioner for Medicaid and health care policy. Both appointments are effective immediately, but subject to legislative approval. Butler was previously the chief medical officer from 2007 to 2009. He left to work for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and more recently worked for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Sherwood is a 25-year veteran of the State Health Department. Scientists know climate change is altering rain and snowfall patterns in Southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest. A new study details how that could affect salmon and suggests what can be done. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Global climate change may become one of the most pressing challenges to Pacific salmon conservation and management for Southeast Alaska in the 21st century. That's the opening statement in a summary of a report released earlier this year by Colin Shanley and David Albert, scientists with the Nature Conservancy's Juneau office. Standing next to a fast-running Juneau Creek, Shanley says the research began by examining about a half century of stream gauge measurements.
By doing that, we can figure out how historical patterns of temperature and precipitation have affected our current stream discharges and things important to salmon.
The researchers looked at how warming temperatures and changing rain and snow patterns have and will affect the sources of streams.
And so those watersheds that are generally fed by deep snowpack in the mountains might see bigger fluctuations in their snowpack, and that in turn affects how much water is in the river throughout the rest of the next summer.
One threat is flooding during the spawning and incubation period. The study projects that will happen more often during key times.
When the salmon run up the river in the fall, they're laying their eggs in the gravel and leaving them there, hoping that they'll hatch. And some of these high water events where you get rain on snow are going to cause more flooding events, or that's what we predict. And so certain streams are more susceptible to scour and loss of salmon eggs.
In other places, streams may have less water and flow slower. That's already happened in parts of central and southern southeast, killing fish.
For the salmon streams that are really reliant on a more consistent rain to maintain adequate flows, you're seeing water temperatures exceed what salmon can really tolerate.
Shanley says some of those scenarios can be addressed. The study recommends restoring or improving damaged streams and rivers. That includes more of the restoration work already being done, including adding trees and stumps.
The wood in the water slows down the water, so that can help with higher water events. It also creates a channel in the stream where the water will actually scour out these deeper pools that'll get cooler, and then they can hide from predators in direct sunlight.
Shanley says fixing culverts and reconnecting diverted streams to wetlands would also help. That's also been done, but he says more is needed. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
This week marks 10 years since the Celandang IU ran aground off Unalaska Island. The vessel lost power and broke in half against the shore, spilling oil and its soybean cargo and leaving 6 crew members dead. It was the biggest shipping disaster in the Aleutians' recent history, and as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, its impacts are still evolving today.
Name a maritime disaster in the Aleutian Islands, and Dan Magone has probably helped clean it up. He's been salvaging shipwrecks since long before a real spill response system was in place. That had changed thanks to the Exxon Valdez by December 2004, when the soybean carrier Celandang IU lost power north of Unalaska. But even then, Magone says,
we were very ill-equipped to deal with a ship of that size.
There was no automatic tracking to give early warning that the 738-foot vessel was in trouble, and no heavy-duty tugboats nearby to rescue it. Tow lines from local tugs kept snapping, and the Celandang's anchors didn't hold. Magone got on scene just as the vessel went aground, and the Coast Guard started airlifting the crew to safety. With a squall moving in, Magone went back to Unalaska.
We landed at the airport, and I got out of the helicopter right as my son was driving by in a welding truck. He pulls off the side of the road, comes over and gives me a great big hug, which is totally out of character. But what I didn't know was the Coast Guard helicopter crashed not long after we left.
6 Celandang crew members were lost at sea, but the Coast Guardsmen survived that crash. Retired Coast Guard Captain Ron Morris, the federal on-scene coordinator for the disaster, remembers meeting them in town.
They still smelled like the jet fuel, whatever they used in the helicopters. I mean, they reeked of, the disaster, essentially.
Meanwhile, the ocean was ripping the Celandang IU in half. The spill that followed poured 336,000 gallons of oil and 66,000 tons of soybeans into the water and onto shore. Magon was ready to start responding, though the weather meant his expectations weren't high. Now he thinks they're lucky if they clean 10% of the spill. Still, Ron Morris says locals were angry at first that the complex multi-agency planning process and lack of nearby equipment delayed the response.
It's just that you're so far away from everything there. You're working on the other side of the island, which is remote as well. And those resources just aren't, you know, around the corner.
Once it began, the project would last 2 years. It was the biggest, longest job Dan McGowan ever took on, and hundreds of locals got involved. Brenda Tellman was hired to scour the beaches for oil, rock by rock, living at the site for weeks on end.
Some beaches were really messy and really stinky, but I think even if you got what we got off, it was better than leaving it there. And we ended up using some seashells that worked pretty good, better than the scrapers itself.
Others worked to keep on Alaska's multi-billion dollar seafood industry safe from any oil that turned up close to town. The big fisheries were unharmed, but the state did close a small tanner crab harvest near the spill. Some fishermen found work at the wreck to make up for lost revenue. Roger Rowland was one of those. When he talks about the Salandang now, he's quick to bring up other local spills, some of them deadly, like the Kuroshima in 1997. He says, yes, the Salandang was dramatic, but it's just one in a long list.
And if you throw in near misses, you can easily call one a year, just right here in our local waters. It's not as out of the box as we might like to think it is. It's just barely outside the box.
Still, that was enough to spark some big changes to spill planning in the region. The Salandang led to Unalaska's emergency towing system, which has come in handy in the past several years. And it resulted in better vessel monitoring, a vital tool in a high-traffic area where weather and human error will always cause problems. But one thing some say might have saved the Salandang hasn't happened, the dedicated heavy-duty tug. Retired Captain Ron Morris says it's a missing piece at either end of the Aleutian chain where thousands of ships cross over as they transit the Pacific.
You know, if you had a vessel, a towing vessel, BADAC, and they're at Unalaska Dutch Harbor, so that you could take care of vessels on the Great Circle Route and those two choke points, you'd have a much better opportunity to conduct a save on a drifting vessel.
That unfilled need has been especially significant for Dan McGowan. A year ago, he merged his decades-old salvage company with Resolve Marine. The international corporation saw an in after the Salandang for one of their tugs, the Resolve Pioneer.
Resolve thought, well, if we could hook up with McGowan and use his facility and, you know, do what he's been doing to try and make income any way we can so that we can have a vessel out there until it's needed. And so that's what evolved there.
But it's not ideal for the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment, a study funded by the settlement from the Salandang that's just now wrapping up. They plan to ask the federal government and other sources for millions of dollars to finance an even bigger tug and a whole new response system. Finding that funding will be a big challenge. It predates the Salandang and still hasn't been solved 10 years down the road. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Hillman. This week on AK, maps. If you want to find a rare book or unusual map in Juneau, there's only one place to go, D. Longenbaugh's shop. Longenbaugh is the owner of The Observatory, a rare bookshop, used bookstore, and treasure trove all in one. You can find everything from local cookbooks about how to prepare halibut to maps of the Great White North. Kayla DeRoche stopped by The Observatory on a recent afternoon and has this profile.
When I arrive, Dee Longenbaugh sits at her computer. Piles of old papers peek out from under her desk. I avoid stepping on them. I don't want to trample documents that look 100 years old. But Longenbaugh says that age doesn't determine the worth of a rare book or a map. For her, it's not so much about what year the map came from, it's more a question of what the map reveals.
Why are these old ones so very different? If you're curious, you want to find out why. What did they believe at that time? And it's the only thing I know that shows the world as our ancestors knew it or thought they knew it.
While her priciest map is $15,000, Longenboss stocks inexpensive maps so that anyone can buy them.
You can have excellent taste and little money, and we all know the opposite can be very true. But I also get people hooked on maps. Maybe you're young, don't have much money. Okay, well, here's a little map for you. And say 5 or 10 years go by, well, now you've got money. Oh, yeah, and you love those maps.
Although Longenbaugh is a business owner, her store began as a passion project when her children had gotten older. She collected around 343 old books about Alaska on trips to San Francisco and New York, enough to set up her bookstore in 1977. So she rented an old house in Sitka's downtown area.
And my sweet older son built me a very nice bookcase, which I still have, and I put the books on display and ran a little ad in the paper, and people started coming, and it was just kind of fun.
Longenbaugh says that it was the first used bookstore in Southeast. In 1989, she and the Observatory moved to Santa Fe for a time, but she says she had a longing for Alaska. She flew back to the state to visit with her daughters, who live in Juneau, and stayed. Longenbaugh originally settled in the Juneau Empire offices. She since ended up on the corner of 3rd and Franklin, where there's a bread shop in the basement. Sometimes the baker's music vibrates up through the floors. Although it's a little quiet during the off-season, Longenbaugh loves meeting the world travelers during the summer months. Some antique owners keep their rarities behind lock and key, but she believes in inviting guests to see and touch her maps. She says one way to tell an old map is genuine is to feel for the Gutenberg Press plate mark, the raised ridge along the side of the paper. She pulls a circa 1763 map of Alaska and Asia from a drawer and spreads it across a table and back. The paper is made out of linen and is thick and pliable.
A reproduction is going to be smooth, of course. If it's real, you feel that plate mark, and you look it over on the other side, there it is, even stronger. That would not come through, of course, on a reproduction.
Longenbaugh also has a group of loyal customers in the community who come for the books. Mary Ellen Frank and her husband have been visiting Longenbaugh's shop for 20 years. Frank crafts figurines and then creates clothing for them that reflects traditional native dress from around Alaska. Her work has been featured in museum collections and exhibitions. She says she's browsed the observatory for research and that Longenbaugh goes above and beyond.
When Dee travels, and she travels worldwide, she keeps her eyes open for things for you, or if she goes into a museum there that she thinks is of particular interest to you, she'll let you know about that, get photographs for you, really share.
And Frank can guess why Longenbaugh is so popular in town.
When you drop by her shop, if there's somebody else there, in no time at all, you're all involved in the conversation. She's just one of those really engaging, charismatic people.
Longenbaugh has a personal attachment to her maps. She says her favorite is a 1570 depiction of Alaska and Asia recreated in the 1600s. She says that Alaska is almost unrecognizable until you spot the Strait of Anian, the former name for the Bering Strait. However, her favorite maps are usually her newest, and she moves around with them.
I take them home, and sometimes I bring them back because I get another one that I like even better.
While certainly at the traditional retirement age, Dee is all about her business. She says it gives her the chance to meet interesting people, examine books and maps, and keep on learning. She doesn't plan to give that up anytime soon. For AK, I'm Kayla Jaroche.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to the native village of Klutika in Copper Center, Alaska.
It's Mark Johns, IGAP coordinator in Klutika. The village is, it's actually the old village is across the river. It was named Sledika, which means where the rivers meet. And then they moved it over this side. I think it's very traditional. Hunting, fishing, songs and dance, and potlatches, and language classes. It's mostly working for the native corporations or Alyeska pipeline. It can be difficult with the oil prices and, you know, just that, and then the food for, or the price for food. It's not that bad though. We're not isolated though. There's a lot of people here, so everybody helps each other out. We could be getting a new road just next summer. It's a big deal. We've had dirt roads all the time. We've never had a paved road or anything like that. We do have a gymnasium that we're working on, and it started back about 16 years ago, and then the funding kind of fell through, and they're actually just now getting that started again, so we should be getting a brand new gym soon, like within a few years, I'm thinking. It's going to have a learning center, office space, and showers, and laundromat, so that's going to be pretty cool. We have the largest community hall in the region. It's the Clutica Memorial Hall. That's where we hold all of our events, and then we have our potlatches and stuff there. Oh yeah, and we have a new church too. It's been up for about 2 years now. We've got all kinds of churches around here though. There's churches for all religions, just about.
Mark Johns lives in Clutica. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Kayla DeRoche, Ashley Schneider, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Liz Bruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.